bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, welcome to the Photo Show. Yes, we're here to discuss the week's photography news and answer your questions. If you've got a question to us, you can send it to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com. We'll ask it. We've got three today, three doozies, absolute pearlers. Joining me to discuss all of the news and all of those things that are fantastic and dandy about your questions is Chris Forsman.
Good morning.
How's it going, pal?
It's going all right.
Good, man. What have you been up to this week?
Just busy working and not sleeping.
Have you actually published something?
I guess it's...
Why are you not sleeping?
I don't know.
Like I say, with a pregnant girlfriend, it's not the obvious.
Yeah, I mean, but it's not. You would assume that, but it's not. I don't know. Maybe I'm trying to mentally prepare myself for come next April, but I don't know.
4 months of training, dude. That's impressive.
You're just too excited about Christmas, aren't you?
That's true.
And that
That's
is the true, dulcet man. Tones of Alex G. Fox, photographer from the South. How you doing, mate?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm all right. I've had a good week. I had a very fun day yesterday running around London and taking pictures of landmarks and taking pictures of teams that were on a team building event for Christmas, turning up at those locations to get extra points by having a photograph taken by me. It was cool. It worked for a firm. It was great. And if you haven't seen my tweet about it, I bumped into Matthew Wright off the telly. There's him being filmed by a cameraman. And I just put my lens up to take a quick picture of him. And before I'd even got it all the way up, he got his two fingers up at me. And then he said, "You're a wanker." There you go.
Well,
which I've got to say, the slipper fits him a little better than it does me, from what I've understood. So there you go. Matthew Wright thinks I'm a wanker.
I'm surprised he knew you that well.
He might what?
I'm surprised he knew you that well.
No, I mean, yeah, I took one picture of the guy in a public place. I'm shooting touristy-like photos. He didn't know me from Adam. And he calls me that. I found that pretty offensive. He's a lucky I'm a placid guy, not prone to violence.
It's probably actually an offence.
A placid wanker.
What, to call me a wanker?
Yeah, I'm sure it is an offence.
Yeah, no, I've got to prove then that it's not true. And then there's that footage of me on the internet, which proves that it is true. Right. The week in photography news, Petapixel has decided that all those pranks that used to be pulled last century during photography, like being on both ends of the photograph, is newsworthy. 50 years ago, they used to pull this crazy crap, was the headline. But I'm paraphrasing there, of course. But I'm sorry, guys. It's not worth it. And Chris correctly pointed out before the show, you can do that with Apple's new panorama sweepy thing. You can be on both ends, so... It's hardly new, kids. One of the things that is quite interesting is Instagram, because Instagram has popped out a few new filters. I'm trying to find the picture of the filters, and it doesn't look like it's come out on the thing.
There's just one. Unfortunately, there's just one new one, and I played around with it a bit, and I'm not that great.
Willow.
Yeah, Willow.
It's the Willow filter. It kind of just underexposes and high keys a black and white image.
Yeah.
That's about it, really.
What the hell has that got to do with Willows?
I don't know. Maybe Willows are prone to high key.
Yeah.
I mean, you wrote a little article about filters, Chris, didn't you, this week?
Yeah, also this week.
In other news?
Yeah, in other news. In other photo filtering news, Twitter added filters to its camera, you know, inside the official Twitter app for iOS and Android, you can take pictures and post them with your tweets, which is great. It comes in handy. But I tend to not use the Twitter app. I use a different app, so it doesn't really matter to me. But they've added some filters, and it honestly just feels like a me too, like let's try to be like Instagram kind of feature, which is kind of sad in and of itself, but even worse, most of the filters aren't very good. They're not very interesting, and they just look cheap and pathetic. And sorry, Twitter.
Well, no, that seems to be the MO of most of the places that do filters. I mean, I've been a very profound critic of Analog App because I think it does a very bad job very badly. So
now
that's a double negative. Does that mean they do it well?
I've had some success with Analog, using Analog, and there's another app that's kind of along the same lines, but a little more advanced, called Flare, made from Icon Factory, and I've actually had a lot of success with both, using them to kind of tweak some photos for my Ars Technica posts, because sometimes what we have to use, you know, sometimes it's supplied, or sometimes we have to find something, you know, maybe a lot of times we get Creative Commons images from Flickr, and sometimes the exposures aren't that great, or it's not that interesting looking, or it's just kind of plain, and sometimes it just helps to kind of give a little bit of, you know, pizzazz to it, and, you know, sometimes it's nice to do it with just one click. It's really fast, and it does it. You know, I could sit, put it in Photoshop and play with it, but it would take too much time.
Yeah. See, one of the things
for what I'm trying to do with it. So
I bought the Analog app to try it, but one of the things that I did was, once I got it in the applications folder, I found out the location in Finder, and I ripped all of the filters out of that and put them into just a standard folder, and then imported those and just used screen and multiply to drop out the effects to apply them to my own photos, and it did it significantly better. The actual filters are fine. The problem is the way that they're applied just makes everything go very grainy and very crummy. And it's the algorithm that's being used in all of these applications that lets down filters that are actually probably fairly decent.
Yeah, and the well, I think there's two sides to this too. There are people who are just simply opposed to the whole concept of the Instagram style filter.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be Alex then.
And he's not alone. He's not alone. And there's people who are just fine with it, like myself. And I don't have anything wrong with it. But I do, you know, I do see a point that, you know, it can be overused. It can get trite. It can be misused. I certainly agree with that. I don't like every filter that Instagram offers. I honestly wish there was a way in the app you could, like, go in the settings and just turn off the ones you never use. Like, I would turn off that Willow one. I'm never going to use it.
Right.
And the really disappointing thing with Twitter is, and I can see too that some people who are just that's the app they use to use Twitter. They're probably not big Instagram users, but maybe they'd like to do that once in a while. And, you know, I can see, okay, maybe it's useful for them, but at the same time, it's like so disappointing because the filters you just aren't really very good.
Chat room saying here, Matt Jim says, I've got mixed feelings about the Flickr app and the way it applies it. It's better in some ways, but also it makes it less useful and less intuitive. Alex, what's your thoughts on the filter process thing?
Oh, it's not really an objection. I think one of the things it's doing is there's a certain section of people that just put a filter on every darn picture they take.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of, it's made for not just lazy photography. It's made for, like, for instance, I did a series of photos on the iPhone a few months ago just to prove that a lot of the things that you're using Instagram to do for you is completely doable if you take the trouble to learn how to take a picture. And so I did some sort of high-key shooting, and I did some things of buildings in London just to say, look, you know, this hasn't got any filters on it. This has got nothing silly on it. It's just, I know how light works. I've got myself in the right position to get the picture that you're sticking some crummy filter on to get. And so I sort of object that what it's doing is, it's making people believe, it's like everything, you know, there are shortcuts to things in life, but you should only really take those shortcuts once you've learnt the long way of doing it. It's like loads of the artists I know, a lot of people go, oh, I could paint that. I go, yeah, you could, but you didn't do the 20 years of the hard slog and the technical knowledge and all the other stuff that allows you the right to be able to do this, which a lot of people don't understand.
There's nothing that drives me nuts more than where my girlfriend does a lot of crafting, and so and she's also she likes to go to these shows. Like there's a Renegade Craft Fair here in Chicago. We went to another one called the One of a Kind Show last weekend, and we're walking around and we look at things, and I was like, "Oh, that looks really cool," and she invariably will say, "Well, I could do that. Why would we pay for that? I can do it." I'm like, "Yeah, but you don't. So why argue about what the price is? Someone else did the work and we're just going to pay them."
There we go, ladies. Chris Forsman's about to be single.
But to these
good thing she doesn't listen to this podcast, huh?
One of the other stories that's out there at the moment is that Facebook has declared openly that Instagram is going to be monetized. Facebook Vice President of Global Marketing Solutions, Carolyn Everson, has confirmed that Facebook will find a way to monetize Instagram. Although the story on Petapixel does say that she avoided mentioning how, like a quarterback dodging linebackers. but she's in charge of ad sales, and they're thinking it might be ads.
I hope that's not how they do it. I mean, let's be fair. Well, we don't even have to be fair, but let's just point out let's just point out the fact that Facebook did spend $1 billion for Twitter.
They're so
I'm sure there's somewhere with an Excel spreadsheet going, we got to balance this out somehow. So I'm sure there's some VP of something somewhere is telling some other VP of something somewhere, like, you know, you got to make some money and blah, blah, blah. So I'm sure there's someone who's under pressure to do something like that, and I feel bad for them.
I've got this thing in my head that the boardroom at Facebook is constantly looking at Mark Zuckerberg and going, Mark, really? $1 billion for Instagram? Couldn't you have just hooked the guy up with your sister's with your girlfriend's sister like he wanted? You know, why'd you have to give him $1 billion? Give him a car.
Yeah, but you think about it. I mean, Facebook that doesn't do anything, achieve anything, or make any money is worth a billion, trillion, zillion, billion dollars. So, you know, Instagram that actually does something should be worth something. But the point is, Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, the three players in this sort of conversation, are all communities, if you like. So, the difference is with Twitter was a community that was being, I take it Instagram, the idea of it, it's like a double post. You post using Instagram to Twitter, but at the same time, you're also doing your Instagramming to your Instagram followers, friends.
Yeah, that's disappearing though, isn't it?
Yeah, and Flickr, and therefore Facebook own it. Now it's going to Facebook. So I can understand what Twitter is saying. It's like, we don't really want to be piggybacked and, you know, Instagram, therefore Facebook, who are basically our rivals, getting the images off of us because of, you know, it's counterintuitive, isn't it? It's to, like, give your competitor a foot up off the back of you. So I can understand what they're doing. But where I think Twitter's gone wrong is, you know, it's the double community thing. I think they could cut off a lot of people because there might be a number of people that have come from Instagram to back on from Instagram to Twitter. So Twitter may have gained something from it, which now they may be being a bit too precious about and handing that all to Facebook. It'd be interesting, but I mean, I understand from reading it that people are hacking it. So you can now still do, or third-party software that's doing multiple posts to absolutely everywhere, including Twitter and Instagram at the same time. So it's like one...
Twitter are clamping down on that, aren't they?
I think there's a third party though that's doing it, and you know, it's something they can't stop.
IFTTT are integrating the two through the back door.
Yeah, but it's a pity because the end user. Sorry,
I think they cut that off though, didn't they?
Oh, have they? Because that was actually a pick now that they hobbled it. Oh, bloody
it's a shame because the end user who is. You know, I mean, it's not me, but it's definitely Chris. The end user is going to have to make decisions because they're not going to want to multiple post themselves. And if Twitter are the aggressor, might be Twitter that loses out in the end.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going into Twitter. It's like they've got dementia and they're just, you know, get off my lawn.
Yeah, it is strange because one thing I have to think about is, I mean, even like most of these apps, photo editing and camera apps for iOS in particular, but you know, one of the benefits of them is that they do share to multiple services. And that's one of the reasons I've always liked Instagram is, I mean, I can just go in and tap a few buttons and I can send it to, I send a lot of my pictures to Flickr, Facebook, and to Twitter at the same time on Instagram. And I'm hitting multiple people that, you know, even though I regularly use all of those services, I have friends, or people who follow me only on Instagram, my people or friends who only follow me on Facebook, or et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I'm reaching a much wider audience. And, you know, like Alex said, I'm not going to go through the trouble and just like, okay, well, I've uploaded Instagram. Now I'm going to copy this photo out of Instagram and put it on my computer and then upload it to Flickr. I'm just not going to do it. So, you know, when they close off these walls, I mean, the whole benefit that people see from these social networks is that they break down walls, and then being able to share among other things and hit multiple sites, and that has been really increased the users and increased the usage. And I think it's a dangerous path to say, well, we don't want to play nice anymore.
Yeah, I agree. I think
Alex is right. I mean, people are already upset with developers that make Twitter apps are upset with, you know, they're constantly cutting off access for developers to the features or cutting them off altogether for new users.
There's an ongoing civil case as well, of course, with what's it that did the tweet thing. Mm-hmm. They've got an injunction at the moment. Excuse me. Right. We've had a couple of letters, not questions, letters. We talked about batteries the other week. The episode is Woes and Woes of Batteries. Hi, newcomer to your show. Blame the crossover thing. This is from Derek in Ricklandsworth that you did with Leo's Bunch. Liking your stuff so far. Thanks very much, mate. You're moaning about batteries on the photo show recently. I had a couple of batches of off-band batteries from China for my 400D ages ago. Some of them were crap and didn't last more than one charge, and others worked fine for 2 years. When I got my 40D, I bought two spare batteries off eBay. Then before they arrived, I forgot that I'd ordered them and bought two more. So I had five batteries, four from China. All worked just fine for 3 or so years that I had the camera. I do rotate my batteries when charging, however. They're numbered so that I make sure I use them in sequence. Apparently, the newer cameras have batteries that are chipped or coded in some way. When I got my 7D, I picked up a spare battery from Power Planet, and that's been working fine, though. I can't tell the difference from the genuine one, except for it cost £11 instead of the full price. The moral of the story, in the old days, cheap replacement batteries were hit and miss, I agree. But these days, cloning is far better, and if not better than the OEM devices, sometimes they're at least level. They're usually a fifth of the price, and so I guess which one I'll be buying. And that price, I'd rather have more batteries and go through them. But I must advise people to charge in rotation. I thought that's a really good tip. Take your batteries and rotate the charges on them, so you're not hammering one out of the batteries all the time. I don't think they don't like panting in the bottom of your photography bag. And in the ongoing saga with Andrew Bailey, we have another development. Now, Andrew Bailey left us a review and we read it out the other week and said, thank you very much, Andrew. He then wrote us a letter saying, I don't remember writing that review.
Maybe it's a different
I must have been
maybe.
Drunk. We've had another letter from Andrew, and Andrew said, all right, guys, this is really getting weird now. I wrote a few weeks ago saying I had no memory of sending a question about the camera adding £10. Then being shocked on hearing my name read out again on the... I was shocked at having my name read out on the show. Well, I was even more shocked last week when I was told I have no memory of writing the iTunes review that Ewan read out. I'm starting to think that after the shutter sound effect at the end of each show, there's a special mind control or memory wiping frequency added to it. Who knows what the other listeners will get up to. I'm going to start stopping the podcast 30 seconds from the end from now on to see if I can regain control of my conscious actions. Yours obediently, Andrew Bailey. P.S. I do, however, agree with the 5-star review I apparently left you.
I may or may not have left.
So next week we'll have a hell of a review from Andrew Bailey about the letter, about the letter, about the review, about the question. So there we go. Good lad.
That subliminal stuff is really clever.
The Canon 6D has been compared to the Canon 5D Mark III in terms of low light performance. Now, I picked up on this mostly because I've just placed an order for one of these. It's on back order at the moment, though. I'm going to have to wait for it. Because I've been having problems shooting in low light with getting too much grain on my 1DS Mark II. And I'd looked at the 5D and Umdenard and whether I should pay for it or not. And then the ISO range on the 6D is huge. So I thought I'll give that a go. And these are really, really interesting comparisons, I think. What they did was basically take a picture against a black background at the various ISO ranges and then try and deliberately boost the gamma on it to see where the noise was created first. And to be honest, the results are quite startling. And the startling bit is where you think, well, the 5D is more expensive, it's a more advanced camera, therefore it's going to be better. No, it's not. It looks like the 6D is actually the winner by some distance across the main ISO ranges, particularly at the 6400. That was an incredible result.
Can't see you needing to go any further than 6400.
No, exactly. But it does go up to 1020, so it's huge. I'm very happy at this. I mean, this is quite interesting because it's a 20-megapixel camera. You would have said that based on price, you'd have gone for the 5D Mark III. 5D Mark III is not that old, but somewhere, I mean, it's like Canon have made a deal with the devil on low ISO, high ISO, low light. Any thoughts on this?
Well, let's keep in mind, too, that these are really long exposures meant for...
trying to get it to screw up.
Photography.
Yeah.
Well, it's meant for astrophotography, and what I'm really curious is how would this look if you're doing shorter exposures in, you know, sketchy lighting, because you're going to have a mix of light areas and shadow areas.
Well, one of the things that they did publish at the end was a little chart on ISO versus for different types. So there's landscape, portrait, and sports. Low light sports, it outperformed the 5D Mark III on that as well as.
Oh, is this the DxO Mark, the test, the bottom?
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Okay. Yeah. So I think you're right, but I'm not sure.
Well, it seems to be doing
so much better in so many ways.
Well, what I think is more revealing, if you look at the just above that, there's a chart where it shows the 6D, the 5D Mark III, and then the 5D Mark II, all side by side. And if you look at that, you can see that the difference between the 6D and the 5D Mark III is actually fairly small, and both of them are much, much better than the 5D Mark II.
Oh, significantly, yeah.
That 5D Mark II is actually quite scary.
The 6400 is incredible. That's just like someone's flicked a paintbrush at it.
It's almost like Where's Wally in Deep Space. It's a pile of, and I don't need to fit a pile of Richard III, I think.
Yeah. I mean...
I was chuffed. I've just having cracked out more than $2,000 for that plus accessories and extra batteries. I'm very chuffed, I have to say, because I wanted it for low light stuff.
Is that British for I'm happy?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Super chuffed.
In a public school sort of way.
I mean, Alex, you're a Nikon man, and Nikon have had the crown for a long time on high ISO, low light. I mean... I'm not going to suggest you're going to jump to Canon all of a sudden, but I mean, are you impressed with this?
It looks comparative. And you know what? I'm glad. I mean, I spoke with you earlier in the week because you were having...
I asked your advice on it.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, it sort of shocks me that, you know, you're using high-end equipment and you're using high-end equipment that just isn't giving you what I say in today's day and age is what you should expect. And I'm really glad to see that you don't have to go out and spend another £6,000 to get what I think should be standard.
Well, to be honest, that was the thing. I wrote Alex an email at the start of the week saying, look, and I've really struggled this weekend. I was in low light conditions and the lighting that I normally get at these locations wasn't there. So I struggle quite significantly to get decent pictures. Every trick in the book was used to push the manual's settings as far as I could. But... I was ready to jump ship and say, right, stuff it, I'm going to have to go to 1DX and that's the end of it. But I looked at the specs on 1DX and there was just this thing in my mind. this doesn't look as good as the 6D. The 6D's got something special about it. And with this test, I'm kind of, and Alex very kindly wrote back with a sense check. They said, why aren't you just buying a 6D?
Yeah, it just seemed, like I said to you, you've got the high end capacity if you need it in your 1D, whatever it's called. But, you know, this 6D, to me, it's the D800 of the Canon range. You know, it's not a cheap camera, but it's by no means an expensive camera. And I think this is, this is what's going to happen more and more with Canon and Nikon. You're going to get pros that are saying, you know, I don't really need to spend $6,000 on a body anymore. I'll spend $2,000 on a body and invest it in good lenses. And though that level of camera is, to be honest, it's more than good enough. It's more than good enough for, in the old days, we say, oh, it's more than good enough for most things. Well, I'd say it's more than good enough for everything.
Well, I'm not. Jim in the chat room's coming out with some comments here that it's only got an 11 focal points and one cross type. Wouldn't you be better with the 5D3? The cross type is the centre one, which is what I shoot on 99% of the time anyway. Then he's saying, oh no, and he says, no, it's a D600 competitor. Well, for a start, it's
better than that.
It's £1,200 more expensive. So
no, the D600 is.
It's a great camera for £600, but it's not even close to what I've seen here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the 600 is. It's not expensive, but I mean, no, I'd say the 600 is not the 6D. I don't know what the equivalent is. It might be the 60D. I don't know because I don't know what the numbers are, you know. But I'd say, yeah, go and spend the extra money if you're going to be sitting on the side of a football pitch and you're going to get. You're going to get one shot at a very fast-moving piece of action that might be in slightly low light. Yeah, go and spend the money if that's what you're going to do. But for anything other than high-end, fast sporting photography, you do not need to spend the money anymore. It's changed, and it's changed dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, this thing's 4.5 frames a second, so it's not going to be anything that the pros are going to want out on the... premiership or anything like that.
The autofocus won't be anywhere near as fast either. No. But, you know,
that's not what I'm interested in.
There's not many of us that would ever use it. I mean, the vast majority of people that take pictures with digital cameras are not shooting things at 9 frames a second that need super, super, super fast autofocus.
Yeah.
I reckon 98% of us would never, ever need that. And to be honest, we would never be able to do it if we could. It's a very, very specialist skill.
I promise myself as well that when my 6D comes, I'll go out on the patio and I'll show you the little setup that I set up to test the thing out for focal length, depth and depth of field and that kind of stuff and ISO range tests and so on. So there you go. I promise. We'll do it over Christmas. Hopefully it's going to be here this week or next week. So we shall see. A new service is out called WedPix. Now, traditionally,
why are we all laughing?
Traditionally, you would have put out some disposable cameras on the tables, and everyone would have taken pictures and then given you back. You'd get them developed, and then everyone would be laughing at them, and you'd try and get them scanned and sent out. The idea of this is, if you take a picture on your smartphone, you can upload it to WedPix, and anyone who takes a picture on their smartphone during your special day, you can get the candid photo that they've taken, as long as you've got admin rights. It's a one-click facility. An instant photo book can be used as well because it'll interface with Facebook. I gotta say, I looked at this, and one of the things that came out from doing the treasure hunt yesterday was that the company said, "Oh, can we have all your pictures to show at the end?" Well, no, not really. I'm going to shoot in RAW unless you can process them. Or I don't know. I could try and put them on my iPad if you want, but I'm on a compact flash, which I haven't got the connector. And they just wanted something to show up. So this idea of having something where everyone can just bomb photos in for a single event and then display it, you can do it with Google through Google Share or through a shared photo stream. But it's not easy. This seems like a good idea.
It's crowdsourcing, isn't it? I mean, that's all it is.
Yeah, but you know your crowd, which is a good thing.
Yeah, but I mean, yes, I think what will come, and this is probably, you know, this is the start of a good idea before somebody bigger and with...
They're into it with Facebook, aren't they? So that's got to be a positive for them.
Yeah, but it will be something that you put with your wedding invitation. It will be, please upload or please blah, blah, and you'll just give an account to somewhere. Facebook or, you know, some web uploader or something. I mean, it's a good idea. All it's doing is putting the word "wed" on something that's already been available and organizing it for people. I mean, to be honest, if someone said, "Oh, I've got a Facebook page, can you upload your stuff to that?" I'd say, "I'll send you a CD, mate." I don't want any part of it myself. But if it's something that is completely and utterly separate from any other of this hateful nonsense that I feel goes on, if it wasn't integrated with Facebook or anything, I'd be all, or for me personally, I'd be much more for it. But, yeah, look, for the majority of people that aren't as grumpy as me, I'm sure they think it's a lovely idea.
Any thoughts, Chris?
So, basically, if you're an old curmudgeon, it's awesome.
Yeah. That'll do.
And if not, then it's the worst thing ever.
Yeah. That'll do. What do you think?
No, I think it's a good idea. You know, I'm just trying to kind of imagine like how the separate app works. Is everybody at the wedding using this app? Do they have to download it? Or is there some other way to work with it? It sounds like you can go like later on and download your pics to it or something. It's a good idea. It's an easy to remember name.
There's a start. But
I'm wondering, kind of like Alex, like though, is it all that more difficult than saying, you know, here's the Facebook album, or you know, here's the Flickr share or whatever it is. I mean, I'm not sure. I think I'd have to try it out to see how I really feel about it, but
that means getting married, dude. Steady on. Let's just we'll do reviews to a point, but we ain't doing that one. Jesus,
talk about taking him off of the team.
Alex, hold him down. Christ,
20 years, man and boy.
Someone. Well, I'm just saying, someone else could get married. I could go to the wedding.
Yeah, I suppose so.
That's pretty non-committal.
Jim says, next there's going to be a divorce website where you go and can separate the photos and rip them up. Well done, mate.
Yeah, I often thought that maybe that should be a service that I could provide. You know, you get these people that do online photo restoration. I'm going to do online divorce photo ripping. That I, you know, you send me your wedding photos and I separate all the people out. So you can have the pictures and the bride gets her side and the groom gets their side and I charge to cut the pictures in half.
Zombie in the chat room says, if it uploads to Facebook album as soon as it's in the app, it could be like a live blogging a wedding. Well, you could live blog the keynotes as well, Chris. There's an interesting one. We've got a load of stories this week that I need to just kind of go through fairly swiftly. This one was quite interesting. It was that Canon have last year filed for a patent for 100% viewable viewfinder. Now you're sitting thinking, well, I don't get that. Hang on, when you look in, you can see everything. No, you can't. Whenever you look into particularly DSLRs, you get percentages of the total view that you'll get. So whatever you see in the viewfinder, when you've taken the picture, there's a strip around the outside that you didn't account for. Now, they've filed a patent saying that they reckon they've got a compact viewfinder which delivers 100% coverage. So there you go. At the moment, you'd be looking at somewhere between 92 and 95%, depending on the brand and model of camera that you've got.
Just remembering, though, I find that, because I use a lot of live view as well, but I find if you stick your eye right on the viewfinder, no, you don't, but you can actually move up and down and left and right in the viewfinder and look at it at angles, and you do recover most of what they're talking about. It's just if you stick your eye right on the end of the viewfinder, you do get about, 96% coverage?
Yeah, I mean, I find...
around and look at angles, you'll find there is a lot more to see.
I mean, very often people's noses get in the way of seeing closer to 95%.
Blimey, I shouldn't be able to see anything then, should I?
Well, I think something interesting here is there have been some SLRs that have 100% coverage, like some of the Canon 1D series. You know, like the Nikon F5 had 100% viewfinder, some of the top end cameras, but the difference is that those viewfinders are also very bulky and expensive. And I think the difference here is that it's a novel design that is easier to produce and less expensive And that's part of the reason why these viewfinders are usually less than 100%. They're smaller, lighter, and less expensive to make.
Yeah, I mean, Jim's talking about the D600 again, but in the story it says the 60D offers 96%, the 650D offers 95%. I didn't think the 600 offered 100%.
It's pretty close. Even in live view. If it's not, I think live view does give you everything, though. Because live view basically is what the sensors see.
Sure, sure.
You got what you got. But, that trick of moving sort of slightly off center through the viewfinder and looking at an angle, you will see a lot. You'll see bits that you didn't know you'd see.
Yeah, Jim says live view definitely does. So.
Yeah.
I'll take his greater knowledge on that one. I don't know. I've only got one of the cameras I've never bothered to check. What else should we do? Nikon have issued some advice saying don't breathe on the end of your lens because the acids in your breath could damage the coating. I've never heard so much bunkum in all my life.
Well, I suppose if you breathe on your lenses constantly 24 hours a day for 7 years, you might find that's true.
I've had oil sprayed on the end of my lenses and bits of chemical fly off and land on it and rain on it containing God knows what in terms of acids.
Right.
I've never had any trouble with coatings disappearing off the end of lenses, and I've had 5 of the lenses that I've got I've shot with consistently for the last 10 years.
Well, people do get a bit precious. If you look through an old lens, the amount of crap that's in it.
Yeah.
You like, look at it and you go, how the hell does that not show up? But none of it does. Because you've got to remember, it's not being focused on any of that.
Yeah.
You know, you're focusing through it. It's like focusing through a window. The window's got to be pretty disgusting for it to show up. And so for, I don't know, the people that care, you know, I suppose technically there is something in the way, but you'd need one of NASA's computers to be able to analyse it enough to see that spec.
Yeah, I've got to take a few of my lenses to pieces, definitely, because they're...
That's suicide, mate.
I'm going to do one. I'm going to find one and do it because it's going to be a hell of an exercise.
I'm wondering if it's not like newer coatings, you know, because one of the things they do is they try to reduce the amount of material they have to put on the lens, you know, so it affects the, chromatic aberrations and all those kind of things less. Maybe it's that the combination of newer coatings with people who do it often that it's causing some kind of problem, like, you know, whereas older lenses, you could do it once in a while and never notice it, or even newer lenses, you might do it once in a while and never notice it. But if you're the kind of person that's doing it a lot by habit or whatever, and the newer coatings are maybe thinner or more, you know, the chemistry is slightly different or whatever, they're more affected by it.
Okay, sensible Chris.
Well, I carry blowers and I carry everything with me all the time. When I'm in the middle of the job, my hanky comes out. I wipe the end of my lens.
Then you wipe the end of your nose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I have been known that if I got a spot on my sensor, I just open it up. I open up the mirror and I just blow on it. It's like, you know what? I can't use this camera the way it is at the moment. If I can manage to blow the crap off it, then I can use it. If not, it's got to go in to be cleaned anyway, so what the hell? And I reckon 80% of the time I can get through the job just by blowing on the sensor. I really don't advise anyone to do that, but, you know, needs must. And if someone tells me I can't wipe my lens when it's filthy with my handkerchief and blow on it, I bought the lens, I'll wipe it with whatever I damn well please. Thank you very much.
Too right, mate. The Matt Jim in chat says it might be sound advice after a good vindaloo. And he also said...
Depends what end you blow on it from.
Could it be about the possibility that the condensation from the breath can mix with the dusts and dirts and turn them into a paste?
And then wipe it off.
Dust paste. There we go. We got some questions. Some fantastic questions this week. I'm going to save question one till the end because it's a bit more of a discussive one. So let's do in reverse order. Question three. Hi, fellas. I own a Canon 450D and I have about £150 to spend on a Christmas present for myself. Suggestions, please. Thanks, Tony G. Cornwall.
Now, is the present for himself?
I guess so. That's what I think he means.
I think we're assuming. It doesn't actually say.
Yeah, we're going to assume it does.
I own a Canon 450D and I got £150 for my wife's Christmas present.
I don't think so.
What should I get?
Suggestions. Have we got a suggestion for someone who's got a Canon 450D? What would be £150 worth of money well spent?
Nice short macro.
Short macro. 50 millimetre 1 to 2.
Yeah, 1 to 2, 2.8 if you can.
Oh, 2.8 for 150 quid? I don't think so.
Yeah, of course you could.
Maybe about 250.
Yeah, you get. Yeah. Yeah, you get less than that. I don't know about Canada. Well, actually.
I've got 150 quid to spend on myself. What's your suggestion? Get another 100 quid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Stop being so cheap. No,
take it to the races.
Windrider says buy a squeaky toy.
Yeah.
Put it all on black.
150 quid, Chris, is about $230.
130?
So what can you get for 230?
Well, I get a 50 milliliter. Another interesting thing, maybe one of the lower end flashes.
You can get a flash for about 60 quid, and you can get yourself a wee tripod for another 100. That'd be good quality.
150 quid to get you quite a nice flash.
150.
You don't go for a Canon make itself. You'd do all right.
You don't need them. I've got a little one. I can't remember the make of it. Begins with an M. And it's as good as my Speedlight by a long way.
Yeah.
Metz, yes, it's Metz. It cost me 60 quid, and it's as good as my 550, which cost me a couple of hundred quid. So there you go. Tony, buy yourself a lens off eBay that's 2.8, short macro, 1 to 2 ratio, or a nice little stand, or decent little flash.
Well, the only thing I'd say is macro can really open up a whole new type of photography. That's the thing I meant by it, really.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Excellent. Question 2. Hello, Ewan, Alex, Chris and Kevin. Kevin's back in the new year, by the way. Still got sound issues. That's why he's not here. Love the show. Thanks. I've got a question about shooting in cities at night. I was out in Newcastle and shooting some of the city lights, etc., and noticed that for no apparent reason, some of the shots were wildly underexposed. I was shooting in aperture priority and the underexposed image appeared to come completely at random. I thought at first I might be on an evaluative metering and not on spot metering, but after checking, I wasn't. In the end, I decided to follow Ewan's advice last week and shoot in manual, and it worked. Is there something obvious I'm missing here, or do you think I have a fault with my camera, perhaps? It's a Nikon D5100. Thanks, Mark Bannister, Newcastle. So he's out in town, he's shooting the lights, and then for no apparent reason, it massively underexposes an image.
Well, it can be literally where if you're shooting literally lights, if you're, I mean, I'm not sure what.
I'd have said this was more like Christmas lights, maybe.
Yeah, but the thing is, if your metering point just so happens to hit exactly on one of those lights, it's going to give you a way, way underexposed picture.
Right.
Because you're exposing for something that might be 10 times the light value of the rest of the image. So,
which would be wild. Yeah,
I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all. What you need to do is, basically meter for the overall exposure. And if you're doing anything like spot metering, you could really be way out.
Well, the only thing that made me think was that if he's shooting in aperture priority and he's on spot metering, then he's pointing to a part press and then refocusing or reframing the image before he follows through with the press.
Yeah.
And I just thought, is there a setting on, I have no clue with the D51, but I know there is on the 600D where it will continue to spot meter even though you've part pressed. It doesn't hold the spot metering.
Yeah, there is something on the back. It's one of these lock, isn't it?
Exposure lock.
Exposure locks. But, they are unbelievably cumbersome.
Mm.
They're, as much as they do their job, I don't know anyone that actually uses them because I can never do it. I have to take my hands off the camera literally to work out what the hell I'm doing. What I tend to do is
if you're shooting something like live view, funny enough,
when you do the metering, if it's changing, you can see it changing. So the metering that you're going to get actually comes through from the live view. So you'll see that it's underexposing as you move along.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting diagnostic, wouldn't it, as well?
Yeah.
Go out again, same settings, same thing. See when it blips on the live view. Yeah, good suggestion. Any thoughts, Chris?
No, I think he's got it right on. It's just that when you're doing automated exposure and you're moving around, and even if you've got an evaluated metering where you've got these multiple points, some of those points are going to be super bright and some are going to be super dark. And that's just, it's going to throw off the metering some. So, I mean, like you said, he switched to manual and bam, hit it every time. That would be my advice to anyone. If you know, find basically find an exposure where you like it. Go get the little info display on your camera, and it'll show you exactly what the aperture and shutter were, and just set that for all of them, and it should all come out great.
Yeah, I mean, what you really need to expose for is to make sure your dark stays dark. Yeah. Without, you know, any problems. So once you've got, exactly as Chris says, once you've got the first one right, it's not going to change anyway, because the overall light situation is what it is. It will change if you're in dusk or something, but once it's already night, it's night. It's not going to get any brighter for a long time. So
I think the other thing that people don't do, which I think a pro would do, is have an understanding of roughly what they'd expect as a ISO versus exposure versus aperture setting. So if I go into a street, I was shooting some last night for the firm in London, and I'm in the middle of St. Paul's, and I'm thinking to myself, well, if I'm on ISO 800 here at f2.8, I'm going to probably be expecting about 80th of a second exposure. And if I then hold the camera up and look at the settings that I'm getting, if that suddenly becomes a thousandth, I know that I've metered off the lights rather than metered off the ambient.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, have an expectation of what you'd expect to see at certain conditions, and that goes back to your testing your camera. And
yeah, but test shot is always, you know, when I go to set up any job, especially if it's a big job, the first shot I do is a test shot.
Mm.
I get everything the way I think it should be. I fire off a test shot, I take all the readings, and if it looks right to me, okay, that is my ballpark for today's shoot. And I always stick roughly around, especially if I'm using flash heads. Because it does complicate it a lot. So once I got the right one down, I do actually write it down on a piece of paper, because I never remember it. So I write it down on a piece of paper, and I know as long as I stay ballpark within a stop or two of there, I know I'm all right for the whole day. Cool. But it's just something you do through trial and error, really.
Good question. Good question. Yeah. Question one. Question three, because it was one, but three. Hi, guys. Not a technical question, but what's the best thing you've ever had the opportunity of shooting, or what are your favourite things to shoot? As an amateur, I get a bit jealous when I see all the pros at the front of a gig or a football match. Is it as good as it looks? James in Watford.
Yes.
I shot images on the European tour for 2 years, and it's quite pleasant. You get some of the pros are really cool as well. They'll post for photos, or they'll have photos with you, and there's some complete tossers, but we won't talk about it. No, we don't name names, Tiger Woods. Did I say Tiger Woods then? I never meant to. I'm so sorry. Chris, let's do two questions then. What's the best thing you've had the opportunity to shoot, and what are your favorite things to shoot? Two questions.
Well, off you go. I think I've talked about this before, but I love doing live band photography. So, you know, yeah, it's awesome. You get a pass to go up in the front, usually in front of the audience, so you're not, you know, trying to shoot over something.
You're in their pictures.
Yeah. Sometimes it's tricky. Sometimes you get like bad locations. Sometimes like you're right in front of a tall stage and you're always just shooting right up, you know, in someone's nose, and it you know, it can be tricky, but it's a fun challenge. And, you know, it depends on the venue. I mean, some venues, they don't care. You know, they're much more casual. You can just bring your camera and shoot and nobody cares. Some venues are, you have to get, you know, pre-approved from the venue, or maybe even from the bands or whatever. So, you know, it can vary. Sometimes the band will let you come on stage and shoot from the stage. Sometimes, you know, you get on a balcony. And, you know, each situation is fun. It's really hard for me to pick a favorite, though. I mean, I've done some really cool, like some really famous bands, like I've shot No Doubt a couple times, Wilco a couple times.
Did Gwen Stefani let you climb on a stage?
No, but here's my story. My girlfriend loves the story because I tell it all the time. But like
enough time yet? Max shows at 3:30. Oh, go ahead, mate. Go on.
Give me 2 minutes here. My serious brush with fame, but it's 1996, and this is when No Doubt is like starting to get famous, and I think that their manager, in fact, that day, like sent, I remember they sent a fax to their bus, to their tour bus. I thought that was really amazing in 1996. I think they were like maybe, I don't know, number 16 on the Billboard charts, and they were just, you know, obviously their minds were blown. I mean, they were just like these four, you know, kids from California that had this punk band, and that now it's like famous. So they're on a tour, and I'm in Dayton, Ohio with them at this little thing. I think it's a hockey arena normally, and they're setting up for the show, and we got there early and we're hanging out. I'm doing like kind of a little interview for, used to do a fanzine, and we're just chatting, and we're, so we go and we hang out, and we are backstage after their set, and you know, this old lady wheels in a cart with all these, like, you know, drinks and little food and snacks and stuff, and there's a bunch of root beer floats on it, which apparently was something that the band likes, root beer floats. So they bring out this cart of root beer floats, and Gwen Stefani grabs one and sits down on the couch that's like right next to me. And she's like, and she says, she looks over, she's like, I don't think I can drink all this. You want to share it with me? And let me just say, my answer was, or something like that.
Was this like the bit in American Pie where it's over twice before it's, yeah, no?
Something like that, yes. So, in 1996, I had a root beer float backstage with Gwen Stefani, and...
That's not a euphemism for anything. That's a root beer float. Yeah. Let's just clear that.
Yeah, it's just a root beer float.
Slightly disappointed.
but my lips touched the same root beer float that her lips touched. So really, when you think about it,
it's you've kissed Gwen Stefani. There we go. Yeah.
Was it seven stages of separation from kitchen window?
Name drop tastic. So in the chat room.
No, I'm not
going to
do it.
Nah, go on, mate. First question. What's the best thing you've ever had the opportunity to shoot?
Best thing? Because Pete, our Australian friend, is in the chat room, I'll say the Ashes.
Oh, but the real ones, not the fake ones that they sent to Australia. Ashes.
I'm not sure I should tell the story. Oh, I can, because it's been fixed, okay?
Yeah.
It's in Lourdes, right? Lourdes Cricket Ground is the centre of cricket for the entire universe, no matter what other people say, okay? And I was there to photograph some various things because they've got a museum there, and there to shoot the Ashes. And the thing is, what a lot of people don't realise, the Ashes people see very occasionally are a replica. The real Ashes never come out of this glass box, this supposedly high-security glass box. Anyway, so I go there, I've done all my work, okay, it's time to shoot the Ashes, and I can't shoot it through there. It's a glass box, it's filthy, it's, you know, no one's bothered polishing it because everyone only ever looks at the replica. So anyway, the guy says, okay, I'll go and get the keys. And about 20 minutes later, nothing. And I just thought, you know, well, I'm just going to see if I can open this. So anyway, I went to lift the glass box, not expecting anything to happen, but the lid just came off. So, okay, I've lifted the glass box off. And I was thinking, well, like, it's not a match day, so if I set all the alarms off, it really doesn't matter. They'll come running in, but, you know, they'll turn them off. I pick up the Ashes, no alarm went off. Okay, I put it on my black velvet setup I'd done. I take the picture. I'm really sort of chuffed to hold the Ashes. I put it all back. I put the lid back. About 20 minutes later, the guy turns up and says, I'm really, really sorry. We can't find anyone to turn the alarm system off. Oh, okay.
Did you tell him it wasn't on at all?
Well, I said, do you want to come back another day? No, it's all right. Why? And I opened up the lid. I picked up the Ashes. I put it on the side. And I said, when's the last time this was opened? And he said, oh, about 20 years ago. I said, you might find that it's stuck.
The buttons,
the whole thing had just like gummed up over 20 years, and no one had actually bothered to lock the glass top anyway. So, yes, it's all been repaired since then. But that's my favourite ever thing that I've ever photographed. I have my other favourite things. And I love history. I really do love my history. And one of the things about the type of photography I do is I go to the historical places, I get access to palaces, I get access to loads and loads of places, but I get access to the places where the public don't go. You know, if it's a royal palace and they want a picture of something in the royal bedroom, well, they shut it down for me, and I go in and I move things around, and I, you know, I set up things. If they want a picture of a bed that Queen Elizabeth slept in, I get the bed rearranged, or I rearrange it, whatever I want. And last year, that's probably the thing I historically enjoyed the most, is I was Lambeth Palace, which is the head of the Church of England. That's where the Archbishop of Canterbury lives in London. And on one day, I photographed Queen Elizabeth I's Bible, and I went back a week later and I photographed Queen Mary's Bible. And anyone that's into British history knows that those two Bibles probably caused the most trouble religiously in, you know, British history ever. And to have sort of photographed and handled both of them and their personal Bibles was, I don't know, it sent a shiver down my spine of actually doing something quite important. And so historically, I found that one of the most amazing things to be a party to. But actual physical thing was playing with the Ashes. It was, to me, it's better than football, it's better than rugby, it's better than anything. And, you know, I don't know what the American equivalent is. It might be the Super Bowl, I don't know. But that was the greatest thing I've photographed or touched. And I hasten to add, the security is now back and it's as high as you could possibly imagine. So I wouldn't go and try and nick the Ashes.
Mate, when the Ashes were burned and put in that urn, and the American frontier still hadn't got as far across as Wyoming, I don't think.
True. There you go.
Mine, I photographed on the European tour for a little while, and a lot of the guys on there are really, really nice. That's a lot of fun. That's got some of the fondest memories. But mine's a Lords one as well. And I shot a wedding at Lords for a friend of a friend. And it turned out that the bride got dressed in the England dressing room. So I was let into the England dressing room to set up. And before she'd even arrived to the venue, I'd shot off two gig cards. I've got all of the honour boards and everything. I've got pictures of me sat on the balcony with my feet up. That's it. Two full cards of me in the England dressing room.
A lovely place.
What do I like shooting the most? I like what I do, to be honest. I see loads and loads of really interesting and fun engineering. Machines that do things that you just wouldn't believe. So I'm happy with that. I do enjoy it. Right, if you've got a question, send it to us. Three corkers this week. Send it to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com. We'll read it out. We'll give you the answer. Thanks to Gabe, he read out that he was humbled and honoured that we'd answered his question last week. You don't have to be honoured. Just send us some questions. We'll answer them for you. Simple as that. And when I get me 60, I promise I'm going to do a little thing out on the patio and show you how to do a little test setup for your camera. Where can we get a hold of you, Mr. Forsman?
You can get a hold of me at rstechnica.com or on the Twitters at Forsmac.
Excellent, mate. And Mr. Alex G. Fox?
You can get me exactly at Alex G. Fox on Twitter.
Good man. You can get me at you and Ranking on Twitter, and we'll be back next week with a whole pile of fun, getting close to the Christmas show. That'll be fun. And we've got the Mac show coming up, and we've got the big show again this evening, so check out all of our other podcasts. Don't forget to vote for us, because we are up for European Podcast of the Year. Mac, Big, Gamer, Media, iOS and Photo, 6 of our shows have been nominated. We need your vote. Go to britishtechnetwork.com and click on those links and they'll take you through to the voting page. Please vote for us, and vote for us multiple times, as much as you possibly can.
Stuff the box.
Yeah, just fill it up.
Chicago style.
Make it look really, really suspicious at how many votes we've got, please. And then we'll win, and then we'll be unbearable. So if BTN can land one award, that would be absolutely fantastic. We came third last year with the Mac show, so we're looking for improvement. And while you're at our site, britishtechnetwork.com, do be sure to click on the sponsors logo and check out UK2, because they support us and they keep us on the air. We would be lost without them. You guys buy lots of service from them, so please continue to do that. And if UK2 went away, we'd go away. That's it. There's no end.
No.
Simple. There's loads of offer codes as well, so you get tons off your basket, and you can put your offer codes in at any time. And if you use that link as well, please just use that to sign into your UK2 account if you're already an existing customer, just to kind of reaffirm that you've come back from us. If you don't use that link, we don't get the kudos for the code. So there we go. And they supply about 450 quid worth of bandwidth each month. We're doing rather well at the moment in iTunes, it would seem. Thank you. UK2.net. Please support them. See you next week. Thanks for listening.
Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.